Welcome to the Mind Dive podcast, brought to you by the Menninger Clinic, a national leader in mental health care. We're your hosts, Dr. Bob Boland
and Dr. Carrie Harrell. Twice monthly, we dive into mental health topics that fascinate us as clinical professionals, and we explore those unexpected dilemmas that arise while treating patients. Join us for all of this, plus the latest research and perspectives from the minds of distinguished colleagues near and far. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Mind Dive podcast. Today, we're very lucky to have Dr. Christopher Thomas. Christopher R. Thomas, he's the Robert L. Stubblefield Professor of Child Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. He is Assistant Dean for Graduate Medical Education and the Director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Residency Training Program, previously at West Psychiatric Institute and Clinic at the University of Pittsburgh. He's been a member of the UTMB faculty since 1992. His undergraduate training was at Rice University, Houston. He graduated from the Baylor College of Medicine, also in Houston. His residency in both general and child psychiatry was at McLean Hospital and part of Harvard University in Boston. So, Dr. Thomas, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to
Thank
have you. You here. You know, so Dr. Thomas, I know you as an expert in many things, including lots of aspects of child psychiatry, medical education, technology for that matter. But today we're kind of going to limit ourselves. I want to talk to you about some of your work with street gangs. And this is an area about you that I don't know very well. So for starters, how did you even get interested in it?
I think it goes back to even before medical school.
You were in a gang?
Funny story about that.
Okay.
The Boy Scout troop that I was in, I didn't realize a local judge would sentence delinquents or adjudicate delinquents to join my Boy Scout troop, since he thought that would be a corrective.
Wow. Okay,
so this is actually, so the actual answer is yes, you were in a gang.
Gang adjacent, we would say.
Yeah, except it, you know, we were the Boy Scouts of America and everything. So I learned how to pick locks, things like that. So good survival skills.
You were saying.
So you got involved at an early age.
No, I think the first time that I became academically interested in it, I actually was going into microbiology. I wanted to specialize in immunopathology. And if you look at all of my early papers, it's in that area that I worked on towards the end of high school and as an undergrad.
Quick question. I usually throw myself in here at this point. Immunophology?
I was going to let it go.
I wasn't. I always, idea. I'm the non-MD.
Immunopathology.
Oh, immunopathology. Okay. Can you just say really quickly what that is, though? It sounds more something I can understand.
But
Kristen. My main work was in terms of the immune reaction and the cellular system, specifically around delayed hypersensitivity with white cells.
Yeah, which is fascinating, but that's not what we're talking about.
I'm sorry. You know, I have to ask these things. Yeah. Okay.
But by the time I got to, everybody did volunteer work prior to medical school to spiff up their application. And like everyone else, I did volunteer work as an art therapist at St. Joe's Hospital in Houston.
Wow.
And that was the first time I really came in contact with individuals who had problems with aggression and impulse control. Mm-hmm. And I expanded on that interest as I was a medical student working at the Baylor emergency room, mm-hmm. where we saw a lot of aggression and violence. And I wanted to do an elective. So I arranged an elective at McLean Mass General Hospital when I was in my junior year of medical school. This was back in 78. Went up there and worked at Bridgewater State Hospital for part of the rotation, which is the maximum security prison for prisoners that have mental problems, mental disorders, or were convicted as guilty but insane. Working with that population, even as a medical student, I could tell that a lot of their issues began in childhood.
Mm.
And so when I entered residency at McLean, I was really pursuing forensic psychiatry as a career. But because of my experience, I thought that if I was going to have any impact at all, I needed to really focus at a younger age of development. And so I added in child psychiatry and did my training. When I graduated, I went to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Western Psychiatric, and started research work with Rolf Loeber and the Family Studies Group. And this was a tri-city study looking at factors influencing development of antisocial behavior in cohorts of youth. And during that time, questions about the influence of gangs started really to come up. You know, I really enjoyed that research and work that I did there. My parents became ill around this time, and I hurried back to Texas and to take care of them. And the only job that was available was as a training director for the Child Psychiatry Fellowship. And so that's how I arrived at UTMB. So they always have a welcome reception for new faculty at UTMB, or at least they did 30 years ago. I'm there, and this was back in 92, talking to this woman who asked me what my work is in, and I said, child psychiatry. And she said, oh, what are your interests in? I said, in aggression and antisocial behavior, disruptive behavior. So conduct disorder, delinquency, those areas. And I didn't realize, I found out that she was the mayor of Galveston. And the next week, I found myself as chair of her youth violence commission. Galveston at that time had suffered, as many cities and smaller communities across the United States, a surge in youth gangs. It began in the late 80s and peaked around 94. In the year prior to my arrival, there were like 17 juvenile homicides within the Galveston region. Now, most of these homicides were youth on youth, and it was getting to be a very serious problem. So the group that I was placed in charge of included the chief of police, a representative from the sheriff's department, the youth court judge, you know, the family court justice, the commissioner for the schools, and representative from the city government and the parks and recreation department. And we added in a representative for a family group. It was specifically parents of children who have been killed by gangs or whose children were in gangs. It was meant to be reconciliation.
So all these important people are looking at you and they say, Dr. Thomas,
what do we
do? How to handle all this, right? Fix and the street gangs.
I mean, the point I'm bringing up is this was not a solo effort. Everything I did, I must attribute to really a very active coalition of concerned public leaders. And I think what really made it successful was that we brought together all these different sections of the community, from the schools, from the city government, from the courts, and from family groups. And I think that that really contributed to the impact. I look back on it now, and I doubt that I would have been able to pull something like that off in a larger community. Galveston at that time was population a little bit above 50,000. Anyway, we started our work, and then we received a fairly healthy grant from the Moody Foundation, which is based here in Galveston. They had a family member that had been affected by gang violence, had been shot and killed. And so they were very concerned in investing in solutions to this problem that was affecting the community and its youth.
Yeah, well, you're probably going to tell me, but I am curious, like what kind of work did you end up doing with the gangs? How did you approach them? What did you do?
Well, you know, like Picasso said, good artists copy and great artists steal. We set about looking at what other communities were doing to deal with youth violence and the issue. And they wanted to call it the Gang Task Force. And I think we shouldn't call it that. I said,
We could workshop that name a little.
Yes. And so we, you know, I insisted we change the name to the Youth Violence Task Force.
On that note, really fast, can I ask, because I don't know that I have a great understanding of this. Are there these gangs, how many of these gangs are there? Were there particular? I mean, I don't know if these are things we want.
I'm just a curious. Hard number. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we did was to try to get information. And I think I still have it somewhere. I made a map of gang activity on the island. And with police and the judge, we were able to at least identify and name most of the gangs on the island. The number of gangs at any one time varies. If they're gang wars, they tend to coalesce. You know, you bring in and you merge, you know, to have a larger group. In times where there isn't any gang conflict going on, they tend to split, mainly because leadership is loose and you have people competing to take over leadership of the group. So, you know, in a community that had a population of approximately around 18,000 youth, between the ages of 10 and 18, that there were about 16 gangs on the island.
Wow!
At the time we started.
How large would a gang be about?
They went from as small as 5 to 6 members all the way up to 20 members.
This is also, I'm sorry, I have one more silly question because I'm wrapping my head around this. Yeah. Would a gang know they're a gang? Do they say
Yes. I mean, that's almost an essential requirement.
Or just this idea that it's these 5 buddies are out harassing other kids.
There you're talking about delinquent peers.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, a delinquent peer group is very different from a gang.
Okay. Okay.
A gang has an identity and they usually have recognized leadership.
Okay.
You know, delinquent peers are, of course, a major factor in terms of the development of adolescent crime and antisocial behavior.
Yeah.
No question about it. But gangs are like delinquent peers on steroids.
Yeah. Okay. That's really helpful. And you said as young as 10 years old?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I even knew of one member that was 9, oh, I think 8 goodness. Or 9. He was sort of like the mascot. Oh. And he was the brother of an older gang member.
I see. What would you say the average age was?
Average age was usually around 15.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've deeply derailed us from the question of how you worked with them, but thank you for those.
Yeah, well, you can tell us how you found out. How'd you find out these things? Did you just go out and introduce yourself?
Talk to them.
Really? No, I'm joking.
Yeah,
really.
I mean,
how does that work?
And talk with the people that worked with them. You know, and we gathered a lot of information. So we divided up our work. And the first thing was to find out what the size of the problem was and what was actually happening. And the second goal that we had was to develop intervention programs.
Mm-hmm.
I set a deadline of 8 months to complete both of those tasks. And so we actually went on, with the support from the Moody Foundation, we went on a number of fact-finding trips to other communities to find out what they were doing in response to youth gangs and to investigate promising interventions. You know, in the end, what kind of came together for me was that there was not going to be one single approach that you really have to think about the factors that push or lead children to pursue antisocial behaviors as covering development from really preschool all the way through adolescence. And just because you intervene at one point doesn't mean that you are going to be successful overall. You had to really have a developmental approach for each stage that would hopefully promote pro-social behaviors and to steer them away from not only gangs, but delinquent behavior.
Such as joining the Boy Scouts of America?
No. No. No, we did not do that.
What kind of things did you do? What sort of interventions might you have?
Okay, well, we came up with several. The first and probably the broadest was a program that we set up with Parks and Recreation. It's long been known that if kids have a strong mentor, a figure that they look up to, be it a parent or some concerned adult, that that is protective against engaging in antisocial behaviors. We had a lot of great recreation directors, you know, basketball coaches, tennis coaches, things like that. But they didn't know how to interact or deal with these kids that were starting to get in trouble or how to counsel them. So we actually set up a training program for them. And we beefed up the summer recreation programs. And basically, if you were going to participate in any of the summer recreation programs sponsored by the city, you couldn't wear gang colors and you could not be involved with gang activity. So we made something very desirable with mentors that would help and intervene. It was very popular.
They gave like a basically alternative.
Yeah. In fact, my son participated. Now, he wasn't necessarily at risk of becoming a gang member. Yeah, you've met my son.
Yes. Yeah. But it sounds like it was a popular program then.
No. I mean, the part of it is you don't want to have just a group of delinquent peers. You want to have a ratio.
That's a good point.
Where there are pro-social model peers. I mean, this is the problem with many residential programs or alternative schools is that, you know, the negative peer models has increased and it creates a culture which is sort of accepting of.
Okay, but let me ask you, like, how did the parents of the supposed good kids take to that? If I found out that my kid was joining a basketball group where some of the people were gang members or former or whatever, I don't know what I.
They were just glad to have, they have all these summer activities.
It probably wasn't like advertised like basketball game for recovering street youth.
Talk. It surely came up.
You know, no, but like, I mean, like Y has a program this summer.
And really all the same. They presumably share stories and probably some bragging and stuff.
The community was really, they were very popular and it was a great program.
Most impressive in this story is Dr. Thomas because he's like in the program and he's like, I'm sending my kid. Yeah. Then you got to know it's a decent program.
Exactly.
he learned, my son learned tennis in the program and actually continued to play tennis through high school and became the captain of his tennis team at college.
Amazing.
Positive things can come out of it for everybody. That was our earliest program to go into effect. It was the easiest to set up and schedule, and it was very popular with the community.
I see.
The second thing in terms of looking at development was in terms of trying to teach problem solving and empathy skills to children in the school. There was, I'm sure you've heard of the Wonder Years program. There's another program that was being marketed at that time, Second Chance.
Okay.
Which helped children in terms of identifying emotions and dealing with problems in pro-social fashion.
These are identified children or just all children or like
all children. We felt that if we were going to do this, we needed to offer it for all children because, you know, otherwise you have this selective process and one, it's hard to predict. And two, you know, if your kid gets pulled out to be in the program, they're going to be asking why are they in this program?
And ultimately, I think that is amazing. In one of the groups I teach to our young adult unit, it's that empathy is often a skill you do have to learn. And so I think that's amazing that kids would be getting some like official kind of help in learning how to do empathy and what that looks like and identifying emotions. I imagine most kids would benefit from that. And then hopefully you're sweeping in the at-risk kids too in there.
It's also a good prevention against involvement in drugs later on in adolescence, because you have the skills then to avoid peer pressure. So we had to do a lot of teacher training and had a number of conferences and implemented that program in half of the schools. We couldn't afford to do all of the schools in the first year. And that way we actually had comparison schools for evaluation of impact.
That's important.
Next program that we did was kind of creative problem solving. There was a big problem with truancy. If one thing is clear, one of the most important things you can do to prevent progressive delinquency in a youth is to keep them in school. The delinquency rates were fairly high. Galveston is, was at that time, approximately one-third each of Hispanic and African American, and about 40% Anglo.
I see.
And a smattering of other ethnicities and cultures. What we knew was that if kids ended up being truant, the possibilities of their dropping out and failing school were greatly increased.
Sure.
The problem for the police force, as we were discussing this in our group, our large group, was that if they pick up a truant child and could not drop the child off with the parents, that the only option that they had was to put them into detention.
Like not obviously like school detention, but like...
No, into detention. It, that was a big problem. You know, I said, well, what does it take to, where can you drop them off? And they said, an approved supervised facility. And I said, well, what does it take to be a supervised facility? And they laid out the requirements. And the head of the Boys and Girls Club, who was another big part of our committee task force, said, well, we could do that. The Boys and Girls Club is not in use during the day. And so we set up with where the police could drop them off there.
Yeah.
And they would be processed. We would get information from them. We had a social worker that would talk with them about what were the reasons for the truancy and refer to resources and then contact the family, and the family could come and pick them up.
Wow.
It was fascinating. I think one of the first youth that we were picking up was a girl that didn't want to go to school because she couldn't get a new set of clothes. And the reason she couldn't get a clean set of clothes was that mom's new boyfriend was abusing her.
Oh my.
And so, of course, we referred them to Child Protective Services.
Yeah,
there were a lot of different reasons, you know, problems. So it ended up where we were adding in tutoring services at the truancy center to help the kids and everything.
So very comprehensive. I mean, but as I say, very comprehensive. I mean, it's starting to sound like a very large program that you're developing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had a lot of moving pieces here. One time we learned through the grapevine that a group of high school students were going to ditch school and go to one of the beaches in Galveston for the day. And so we just had a police van pre-positioned there. And so when they showed up, they just
get out, really?
Okay, get in the van, you know, take them to the truancy.
I'm glad no one did that for us on our senior ditch day.
So it was quite effective. And the dropout rates dropped dramatically, and high school graduation rates improved amongst all categories.
It sounds like in general, you're pretty good at keeping outcomes data.
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Which would be important. I think a lot of programs like this don't really do that.
The final thing that we wanted to do was provide a community-based intervention for delinquents that are just at the point of being sent out of the community, sent to either, you know, state school or some other correctional facility. And we call that the last chance program. Around that time, Scott Hengler and his work group had been promoting multi-systemic family therapy, which is, I'm sure you've heard of, a very effective program in working with severe delinquency and addiction in youth. We contacted them and they agreed. We actually became the first independent site to implement MSFT. It was really good. We had three counselors. They were each working with about four youth. One of the judges, family court judge was there, said, "Well, you know, Dr. Thomas, do you want us to sentence them to this program?" And I was there like, "No, you can't do that. It's an experimental program. It's not."
We try sentence people to therapy, right?
Like, you know, and actually, it wasn't sentence; it was adjudicate. You know, make it as terms. And I said, "You can't do that because it's a therapy, and it has to be optional." And judge kind of rolled his eyes and said, "I don't think that many kids will and families will sign up." Out of the 100 families that were eligible in the first year, 91 families agreed to participate.
Wow.
And we only had, I think, 10 families drop out.
Yeah. I'm guessing calling it the last chance, it probably helped motivate them.
I don't think they knew the name.
Oh, I see.
Well, and I imagine too, like that just speaks to like what a need there was in the community for this, the family. I mean, like you said, like developmentally, the families have to be part of this, you know?
Yeah, it makes sense.
But I think most people have the idea that many parents have written off their
that would be a stereotype
adolescent children. And the fact is they're really wanting help. And I think everybody deserves that opportunity. I remember one time we got the Mayor's Council Award for community program the second year that we were operating. And when they were coming to interview, I learned later, when they were interviewing the police chief, they said, "You know, Dr. Thomas, he's really nice and we like him, but he thinks we can save them all." And I wish that were so, but I know it's not. And I think it would be more accurate to say we can't tell the difference between the ones that we can save and the ones we can't. And therefore, everybody deserves a chance. Everybody needs a chance.
Sure. I imagine you approached, it probably took a good deal of optimism on your part, though, to do something like this.
Anyway, we reached our three-year objectives within the first year of operations.
Wow.
Homicides dropped to zero.
No way.
And I think there were a lot of other factors. I wouldn't lay it out to the community.
Still, that's impressive.
That's amazing.
But the interesting thing is, usually interventions on violence and with delinquency don't show an impact on nonviolent crime. We actually found that there was an 80% drop in nonviolent crime.
Such as?
Stealing.
Theft.
Shoplifting.
Vandalism,
that sort of stuff.
Wow. Well done.
But anyway, so that's kind of the program in a short summary.
Did it continue past the grant?
Some portions did. Not all. Unfortunately, for the empathy training in the schools, that was right before the introduction of STAR testing and everything. And so school resources got, and teacher time and teacher training was shifted away from that and focused on passing the STAR test.
When did STAR testing start?
When George Bush, became
governor.
Child
Left Behind, I think. Right?
Yeah. So that was... I think that was a later administration, but
that was an unhelpful question. STAR testing has been around my whole life.
Okay.
But there was a time where it wasn't, they could have focused on other things, but I did receive funding from the Department of Justice for a number of years that would allow me to continue. I did put in for other private and federal grant support, but the interest in, you know, these kind of programs, which were more service oriented than they were rigorous research studies, was not so great.
All right.
And I think, you know, the pressure to do it was decreased. Mm-hmm. You know, what we know now from the research looking back on it, you know, back then there was all this talk about, you know, a hyper violent adolescent being bred and everything like that, that we were seeing some new phenomenon in delinquency and everything, turned out to be false.
Yeah.
That most of what was going on was the cocaine trade. And that was what was driving the gangs, because adolescents could be runners and salespeople at the end, that where they would not get to direct contact with the supplier. And so the supplier was less likely to be arrested. And that's what really fueled the creation of these adolescent gangs outside of traditional gang cities like Chicago, New York, LA, that sort of thing.
Let me ask you, we have probably a few things we want to learn from your experience working in this, and we probably won't have time for long, comprehensive answers, but just to get a sense of it, like, for instance, like, is there a type, like, who joins a gang? Like, what kind of people did you see who seem to be at risk for that?
Kids that have been rejected by their parents. You know, parents that say, I wish I never had you. You're no child of mine, that sort of thing. You know, talking to several gang members, the thing that they talk about, it, they said universally, it's not a gang, it's my family. These are my brothers. We watch each other's back. You know, another thing that I learned, it's just like real estate, you know, location, location, location for gangs. I thought, you know, there was a central single school system for the entire city of Galveston. This is back before charter schools and everything. So there was just one single school system. And I thought, you know, once you hit high school, there could be these gangs that draw members from across the island. And that was not true. Most gangs, you know, drew their membership from six square city blocks.
Wow.
Sometimes even smaller. And the interesting thing, if a neighborhood was integrated, the gang would be integrated. And if the neighborhood was segregated, the gang was segregated.
That would make sense. Well, I'm thinking too, I really like this idea about identity and connection, and like in the absence of a family that you feel connected to, that this would be so important. And I wonder about interventions, or how was any of the programming that y'all designed like to function around giving them like a joint mission or identity or group connectedness?
I think the main thing is, in recommendation and in retrospect, you know, do everything you can to keep them in school. And have somebody that is monitoring and has expectations, but obviously is going to be in for the long haul for them. One thing we had to do was actually teach them how to get out of a gang. Gangs didn't like losing members.
Wow, that's
a- Now, the idea about, I mean, the myth that once in a gang, always in a gang.
No, that's what I was wondering.
Oh, would you say when you're a jet, you're a jet all the way?
No, that's not true. That's false. You know, that the majority of gang members grow out and leave it behind. But it's helping them leave it behind is the important thing. And we noticed having a job and or having a girlfriend made a real difference in terms of, you know, trying to straighten up and fly right. You know, because if you have a job, you got to show up. And you can, so that means you got to get some sleep the night before. You can't be out roaming until 3 or 4 a.m., that sort of thing.
This is not really a question, but more of a reflection. I'm thinking about as a therapist, and our audience is in general mental health practitioners. I imagine if you get a kid like this and you're getting them in the mental health system, like 90%, I don't know. I don't want to quantify that way. A lot of the work is done. Like, you know, you now this person could be in therapy, learning those empathy skills, getting connected to other resources. I'm thinking about the kids who, you know, especially these kids who are at risk because they don't have a family they feel very connected to. Like, how do we reach them? How do we get to these kids to get them supported? And I actually think that's why I'm appreciating the work that you did in Galveston, because I feel like it's setting the stage, or again, it's maybe modeling that we need community programs. We need outreach.
I think that can work. I think the important principle is to recognize what the needs are. Another thing I would point out about gangs is that for the youth that we tracked longitudinally, if they got out of a gang, their antisocial behaviors, frequency and severity would drop to the level that it was before they got into a gang.
Right. So really the gangs.
So that's why I say the gangs are like, you know, delinquent peers on steroids.
Yeah.
The one thing that didn't change was drug addiction, drug use.
Well, that checks out.
And that was a hard thing to break. And as we know from other research, that it's a two-way street with addiction and antisocial behavior. And that if you influence one, you can influence the other. But the impact on ending addiction is much more powerful on conduct disorder than vice versa.
Imagine so. Is that the most common like mental health problem you'd see among kids?
You mean amongst the gang members?
Yeah.
I mean, in a fair percentage. I think I also saw a lot of ADHD and anxiety disorders. It's similar to what you find in terms of the studies that are done on juvenile detention or delinquent populations, that, you know, conduct disorders probably make up about, you know, 30-40%, but you have higher percentages in terms of drugs and in terms of anxiety and depression.
And trauma?
I would think trauma, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, if I were a parent with a kid that I was worried was becoming interested in a gang, like, and came to you, what advice would you give me?
I think the most important thing is to know their friends and to involve them in activities, structure activities. And, you know, if any kid is acting up, then they can't be in on what we're doing at the park. Or the most amazing stepdad I ever met was a police officer who brought his stepson into a clinic when I was in Pittsburgh and wanted evaluation for oppositional defiant disorder and antisocial behavior. And the kid had really improved when this guy came into his life. He said, I'm going to take you to the ballpark. I'm going to play basketball with you. We'll go swimming. We'll go fishing. You can bring along the friends, but they have to abide by my rules. And if they don't, then they can't belong. Mm-hmm. And so he really made a strong alliance with this kid. And the kid started ending up with better peers because, you know, he couldn't hang out with any of the more antisocial peers. And, you know, the stepdad was there and he said, well, what else do I need to do? And I said, you're perfect. You know, I want to hire you. You know, and I think he was very upset with me that, you know, there wasn't anything else that I would recommend.
Have magic for him or something. Or,
yeah. Wow. And I said, you know, look at what all you've done, and you know, just keep it up. It's the long haul. But it makes the difference.
That, I mean, this is probably too big of a question, but do you find in general that's sort of the answer to treatment of antisocial personality disorder is kind of social type treatment?
Definitely. Well, for younger kids, you know, at the top of the list is behavioral programs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And along with that, mentoring. I think there's something to be said for empathy training and problem solving skills, although the research on that is kind of variable. But I think that, you know, you want to bring all of those techniques to bear with children up to the age of 12 or 13. Older than 13, again, behavioral techniques. But I think you also have to look and treat any comorbid psychiatric disorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kim Pujanic, who was my boss in Pittsburgh, one of his main area of research was in depression and anxiety in adolescence. And he wrote a paper where he had a subgroup of depressed adolescent boys. And he noted that if their depression improved, whether it was due to medications and psychotherapy or just got better on its own, that their antisocial behaviors improved and they no longer met criteria for conduct disorder. And so, you know, my philosophy has always been treat any comorbid disorder, especially if they have addictions. I think the other thing for adolescents is to make sure that they are successful at school and don't drop out and are able to see a future for themselves.
You know, this has been very more optimistic than I expected. I mean, there's so much nihilism around this subject sometimes in kids and violence. And it's kind of very uplifting to hear that, you know, that's things can be done and that you've done them. That's very, so thank you for that. Once again, Aaron, this has been Dr. Christopher Thomas, who's been talking with us today. And this is the Mind Dive Podcast. I'm your host, Bob Bowen.
And I'm Dr. Carrie Harrell. And we would like to give our guest the last word if there's anything that you'd like to kind of end on, Dr. Thomas.
I think what I said earlier, that you may not be able to save every kid, but every kid deserves a chance because we can't tell them apart.
Fair enough.
I absolutely love that. We do like to remind people that if you do like our show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
And this, once again, this is the Mind Dive Podcast.
Thanks for diving in. The Mind Dive Podcast is presented by the Menninger Clinic. If you're curious about the professional experiences of mental health clinicians, make sure to subscribe wherever you listen.
For more episodes like this, visit www.menningerclinic.org.
To submit a topic for discussion, send us an email at podcast@menninger.edu.